had to step outside of my comfort zone because I felt that it was my duty.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, here with my co-host, Susan Franzen. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
Well, Susan, the weather is not much better today than it was the last time I saw you on Saturday during the People's Climate March in Des Moines.
That's right. We both got out of our comfort zone in the cold rain for that one.
And we're going to talk about the climate march in a bit, but first, weather and climate are related. We're going to have a word on this coming week's weather from climatologist Elwin Taylor.
Well, we certainly had more than our share of rain, it seems like, this past week, and in very cool temperatures to start out the month of May. We're talking weather right now with ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor. Will this cool, wet, damp weather continue on here, Elwin?
Well, I don't think it's going to continue too long. Looking at the National Weather Service forecast as we go through the week, we're going to have high temperatures tomorrow near 60, and for the next day and the day after that, that isn't particularly warm. Cool temperatures at night in the 40s, and that isn't too bad. We do anticipate that, yes, there will still be a chance of showers a little bit later in the week. And then I start to look at the 6 to 10 day outlook, and that's where we're seeing the change. Now, I'm not sure that the 6 to 10 day outlook is going to stay the way it is now. A lot of times they modify that when they've taken a look at how the week starts off. Nevertheless, the 6 to 10 day outlook does show that we are going to expect to move to warmer than usual again for probably at least 4 or 5 days, and maybe on the dry side as usual. That will be a relief to both farmers and to the crops that are already in the ground to get the soil warming back up. So things looking good there, and really not a bad outlook ahead once we get through this 2 or 3 days with a large storm that's come up from the Gulf that's covered half of the center of the U.S. in one big storm area. But it doesn't look like it will stay bad past tomorrow in most of the Midwest. And remember, there's still some chance a little bit later in the week of some precipitation.
ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor talking with us. I'm Von Kettleson.
And we are so grateful to Von Kettleson and Dr. Elwin Taylor for providing us their weather reports every week. So the main topic of today's show is climate change and the People's Climate March that manifested all over the country on Saturday, which was also Donald Trump's 100th day in office. On Saturday, it was 80 degrees in Washington, D.C. It was snowing in Denver. And here in Des Moines, where my cohort host Susan and I were, it was cold and wet.
And in Des Moines, it was such a contrast to the previous weekend's Science March, which had fair weather and very large crowds. For the People's Climate March, we were just a couple hundred, huddled under our umbrellas.
And the speakers were gathered under a tent, and every so often, the wind would lift the roof of the tent and spill huge puddles of water that had gathered there.
That's why it was so great to have, as the final speech, Heather Pearson, who is facing a suit brought against her by the state of Iowa for trespassing a pipeline easement.
Now, for the last 7 days, we have marched 85 miles across Iowa to discuss climate justice and unity with rural communities along the way. Now, this was definitely outside of my comfort zone to agree to march 85 miles. But it's not the first time that this fight has taken me outside of my comfort zone. Now, most Iowans have been opposed to the Dakota Access Pipeline since it was proposed 3 years ago. I was asked to give testimony in front of the Iowa Utilities Board, and I had never been to Boone before. I didn't know a single person there. So again, I had to step outside of my comfort zone. I told the board that I find it appalling that they were so willing to trample Iowans' private property rights while putting our air, our farmland, our water, and our climate at risk, just so a private corporation can fatten its bottom line with an export pipeline. Now, in August, I got a call from Ed Fallon, and he asked me if I would be willing to risk arrest while participating in some peaceful civil disobedience. I had never been arrested before. I had never had any interaction with law enforcement. In the days leading up to that direct action, I was so anxious. I had to, once again, step outside of my comfort zone to follow through because I felt that it was my duty. I had signed the Nobakken Pledge of Resistance, and the movement needed people power. Then I was handcuffed and taken away.
And that was Heather Pearson with a speech that wrapped up Saturday's climate march. She had a few more moments in which she stepped outside her comfort zone, including when she was arrested on Shirley Gurgit's farm. That was the incident that is bringing her to a lawsuit with the state of Iowa. At any rate, being out of our comfort zone had great relevance for everyone there at the march.
But the differences between the Science March and the People's Climate March really went beyond that. At the Science March and teach-ins, we heard a lot about diversity, getting diverse opinions on science, getting younger or underrepresented groups into do science. There was an effort to be bipartisan. The final speaker even urged the crowd to be open to the importance of GMOs. But you could say that while the Science March talked the talk of diversity, the Climate March walked the walk.
Literally, a large group of the speakers had walked through the rain for 85 miles to get to the event.
And the first speakers were from the Meskwaki settlement. Let's listen to Shelley Buffalo first.
Thank you, everybody, for coming here today. I have walked all 85 miles from Little Creek Camp near Millersburg, Iowa, to the state capital of Des Moines. And I want to tell you that each step I took was a prayer. It's a prayer for the earth. It's a prayer for all of you. What we are facing here today is not a political issue. This is a spiritual issue. Our society is sick, and it's making our earth sick. So I am poor. I live at the poverty level. I'm a minority. I'm a woman. I'm a single mother. So I'm a Meskwaki Indian. I'm Native American. So, you know, all of those means I'm in one of the most marginalized demographics in the United States population. You know, I've been knowing for years, decades actually, since my childhood, that things need to change. But I did not feel empowered to change anything. But I found my courage at Standing Rock. I learned about the power and the healing of prayer. And I want you to keep that in mind. This, what we are facing now is the ultimate misogyny, all right? Our earth is the feminine that provides everything we need to sustain us. And we have a type of misogyny going on that has no respect for that whatsoever. And we live in a society that does not respect the feminine. And that's what really needs to change. This is why I have walked. Yesterday I had to take my skirt off because it got too waterlogged. But I have worn this for the entire march because this represents my womanhood. And this is my perspective, that we really need to bring the world back in balance. This isn't about feminism or anything political or anything intellectual about that. This is spiritual. We are always praying for all of you. Please find your courage. Even I found it, and I found my voice.
And what a lovely voice it was, Shelley Buffalo from the Meskwaki settlement at the People's Climate March. Now, you know, we're talking about diversity and the diverse voices that we heard there. Akko Abdul Samad, the black Muslim legislator from Des Moines, broke out in a very powerful speech on Saturday, taking head on some of the issues that come to bear when you brand your march a unity march and bring people of different backgrounds together.
Yes, he was a powerful speaker and really represents the tremendous spirit of this event.
Because you are going to make a difference. You are going to go and leave this rally, and you're going to meet with your neighbors. You're going to meet with your legislators. You're going to meet with people who don't understand, and you're going to educate them because you're about doing the work You are the activist to make change. And we're not going to let people talk down about being an activist. Activism changed the world. Activism created free breakfast programs. Activism stood up and made sure that the pipeline was noted and educated people across this country. Activists have stood up to make changes, and you don't worry about what people say because you're willing to stand for what matters. Woo. I'm not worried about the President of the United States, because if we do what we're supposed to do, it'll be a one-term president. Yeah. And I heard last night when I went to Pleasant Hill, I heard one of my Native American sisters. She said, one of the problems is that you don't understand me, because history doesn't teach you about me. So that means we have to understand our differences so that our similarities have something. I am different from you, but not as a human being, but my culture is different. Don't be afraid of that culture. You're not afraid because I'm Muslim, that I'm African American. What it is, you learn it as a learning tool. I'm not afraid because you're a white woman. I want to learn what your pain is. I'm not afraid because you're Latino or you're from Meskwaki. I want to learn so that we can join forces, so we have a greater issue to fight for.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Greta Anderson here with Susan Franzen. We went to the People's Climate March in Des Moines on Saturday, and they are here reporting on it. You know, we just heard Representative Abdul Samad mentioning Donald Trump, but there was not a whole lot of talk about him. One of the speakers even urged the crowd not to talk about Trump, to talk about the issues instead.
Although it should be noted, on the very day before the climate march, Trump had the EPA wipe its website of all information about climate change. If you go to the EPA website, you'll see all information was taken down Friday night, the very day before thousands of people marched for climate justice.
I heard there were 200,000 marchers in D.C. alone. But I think we really need to pay attention to this message of climate justice, because it is the poor and vulnerable, just like Shelley Buffalo, who are affected first.
And when I spoke to one of the organizers, Carrie Carney, of 1,000 Friends of Iowa, she spoke of the frontline communities.
The communities that are affected first.
That's right.
By global climate change. And so it was very appropriate that the organizers included among their speakers a Syrian-American man to report on how climate change fueled the devastating human tragedy taking place in his country.
It has been well established by environmental scientists that the current human and political crisis my home country, Syria, is undergoing is attributed in one strong reason to global warming. A severe drought fled Syria from 2007 to 2010. That drought was said to have been the worst ever recorded, but it was one in a long sequence. Just in the period from 2001 to 2010, Syria had 60 significant dust storms. 4 years of devastating drought beginning in 2006 caused at least 800,000 farmers to lose their entire livelihood, and about 200,000 simply abandoned their land. Crop failure reached 75%, and generally as much as 85% of livestock died of thirst or hunger. Hundreds of thousands of Syria farmers gave up, abandoned their farms, and fled to the cities and towns in search of almost non-existent jobs and severely short food supplies.
Of course, among the people most affected by climate change are the youth. And so the organizers had a young person bring her voice to the rally.
And she was a remarkable young woman, Ellery McAllister, with a very important message.
My name is Ellery McAllister. I'm a 15-year-old student and a sophomore at Roosevelt High School. I've lived in Iowa my whole life. A year and a half ago, I joined Des Moines Division of iMatter, a group that empowers youth in a world where the adults right now are failing to protect the climate. Last April, iMatter gave a report card to the City Council about our energy use. We got a C-, which is better than it could have been, but that C- Earth is the one that I'm inheriting. I'm sure that that's not the future you want for your children. Climate change is really about the haves stepping on the have-nots. And though I may be a queer woman living under Trump, I cannot deny that I am a have. The car I drove here in was powered on the backs of poor women across the globe, members of my family, our family, that are being left behind. Yes. So many have had everything taken from them. What are we willing to give? Youth from iMatter have teamed up with other groups in Des Moines to form a climate action coalition. We hacked a city council meeting and convinced them to create an official sustainability task force. Now we need researchers and activists to help task force members move Des Moines toward a better future. We as a city need to do our part to keep the climate movement on track while this administration is doing everything to derail it. We may be suffering on a federal level, we may be suffering on a state level, but the local level still has hope and still has opportunity to make change. Both youth and adults can join the task force and change the world for future generations of children. Thank you.
Ellery was talking about Des Moines, but of course her message pertains to us here in Ames and other central Iowa communities. It's about what we can do locally. Here in Ames, we are developing plans for the first solar farm.
And there are at least 200 people, as of last week, who want to help support refugees, such as the people the Syrian gentleman described here in Ames. There's so much going on in our community.
And KHOI is really the best place to hear about it all.
Our listeners may think this sounds like a pitch, and yes, it is. We are getting close to reaching our goal for this fund drive of meeting the $15,000 matching grant that our generous donors have held out there for us. But we need your help to get us there.
Let's not forget the goal of 25 new members as well.
That's right. If you've been hiding out, enjoying the community that KHOI brings to your doorstep, you need to realize that although Susan and I are volunteers and our wonderful studio engineer this morning, Cynthia McClure, is a volunteer, the station does have fixed costs that it must meet. We pay an engineer to keep the shows running on schedule. We pay a manager.
And we pay our bills.
That number 515 200, can you fill it?
7758.
That's our text where you can just text us and tell us how much you'd like to donate, and then simple questions will take you the rest of the way. Well, before we leave this issue of climate justice, we should direct our listeners to our archives from Saturday. Pacifica Radio, which brings us much of the great programming that we have throughout the week on KHOI, did a live broadcast of the Climate March in Washington, D.C., and as part of that, they interviewed Winona LaDuke of White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. Winona has been conducting her own pipeline fight up there, and we think our listeners will be interested in hearing her perspectives. Here's Winona LaDuke from Saturday's Pacifica broadcast of the People's March for Climate Justice.
I come from northern Minnesota, and I live on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, and we don't have any oil. We're all doing pretty good. We got our sacred wild rice. We defeated the genetic engineering of our wild rice a few years ago. And then one day I read that the Enbridge Corporation, single largest pipeline company in North America, has announced it wants to run a pipeline across our territory right next to our single largest wild rice bed. And it's a 640,000 barrel per day fracked oil pipeline they want to run out of North Dakota. And so we organized. We spent about three years. We prayed. We had a lot of ceremonies. We rode our horses against the current of the oil. I dreamed we should do that. We did that. Colleagues of ours, friends of the headwaters, filed a lawsuit which required an environmental impact statement. You know, we really pushed, you know, against that pipeline. And then one day, August 2nd of last year, that corporation, the Enbridge Corporation, one day after our spiritual ride, one day after the Enbridge Corporation announced that it was no longer going to continue with their project called the Sandpiper, that they'd canceled their project, they were going to withdraw the permit applications, and that company has decided that it's going to instead purchase 28% of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so they went west, and I know that you just got that story from my friend Judith LeBlanc, but, you know, that's what happened to the Enbridge company is they went west and they bought 28% of the Dakota Access Pipeline. They thought that that all worked out for them. Well, we were all out there. I was out there quite a bit. Our community sent hundreds of people out there. And then in December this last year, we knew it was coming. Enbridge announces it wants to come back in exactly the same corridor with a new pipe, and that pipe will be called Line 3. Line 3 is a 915,000 barrel per day tar sands pipeline coming out of Alberta, dirtiest oil in the world, and this would make it the largest pipeline, and this is the largest pipeline corridor in the north. And what we have here is a corporation, Enbridge. It has a bunch of pipes already across the north. They go across what's known as Highway 2, and those pipes are old. They're as old as me, like they're 56 years old. And that was before the – I'm good, man, but I'm not a pipe. You know, these guys are – they were put in before the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. They were put in with a kind of steel that was not used to tar sands oil. They got this problem now that these pipes are so darn old, and they got structural anomalies in them. That's what you call it, structural anomalies. And structural anomalies is when you you have things like the Kalamazoo spill. That was a structural anomaly, a little pinhole leak that, you know, takes them 17 hours to stop, get it, you know, whole bunch of 800,000 gallons of oil, or, you know, this one, they refer to this as in a state of deterioration. This is one old pipe. And so rather than, you know, this is the single largest inland oil spills in the U.S., both of them were Enbridge pipes. One was in Kalamazoo in 2010, and then there was one in northern Minnesota. 1.7 million gallons of oil in March of 1991, all Line 3. So then what they decide they want to do, they realize it's kind of fallen apart, state of deterioration, 10,000, 12,000 possible structural problems in that pipe. And then they say, just to start with, I mean, they estimate they may have over a million structural anomalies, about one every 10 feet. So what they decide to do is abandon that pipe. And then get a new route. And so we got a big battle here, you know, and Enbridge announced it. They're coming back in. And, you know, what we feel like is I do my best. I parented a few children here. And I got this deal that I try to work, which is you got to clean up your old mess before you make a new mess. And that company just want to abandon their mess with all those pinhole leaks and structural anomalies and how much hydrocarbon contamination and, like, Leech Lake, which is 50% water. That reservation, Leech Lake Reservation. And so, you know, we're saying that's not going to work out. And Enbridge is the largest pipeline company in North America. And Enbridge has got a couple of lines out there that they're trying to put in. The Sable is one of theirs. And there's another one up by New York. We've seen Enbridge, they come in. And the first time they come in, they said for announcing, they had a little party to announce their Line 3 expansion. I think they just thought they was going to have some white landowners who was ready to take some money from them. But that wasn't really the case. They had an opening on December 13th up here in Bemidji, and I went in there and tried to ask them a question. I said, Enbridge, you know, Enbridge, I said, we got some questions for you. We was all out in North Dakota, and what we feel like is that you're responsible, 28%. Of that financing. I kept asking them. I said, you should demilitarize that situation, Enbridge. You're a corporation that wants to do business with Indian people, and this is not how you do business. And they did nothing. So we hold that company responsible for 28% of the injuries, 28% of the arrests, 28% of the bullets. And they have no social license to operate in Minnesota, and we're fighting them. But it's a huge battle here in Minnesota for Enbridge's single largest project, a $7 billion pipeline project. So that's what I'm facing.
Winona, when you mentioned the 28%, there are activists here in Washington, D.C., who will be in front of the John Wilson Building, which is the D.C. government headquarters, passing out literature to encourage marchers today to get on the D.C. Council to divest its investments in the Dakota Access Pipeline. So there will be activists here, and, you know, it is encouraging to see so many universal repetitions of these same themes all over the country.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, as I look at it, I refer to this as the Wendigo economy. The Wendigo economy, which is, you know, in a long time ago, that's like a, you know, a monster cannibal that come into our villages and destroy villages. And that's pretty much what this economics is. It's, you know, and Trump kind of is the manifestation, is incarnate of that, you know, of no regard for anything, no regard for life, no regard for dignity, no regard for, you know, I would call it the rules of engagement of civil society, like the Constitution. You know, no regard for any of that, and just continuing ahead to, you know, with cronyism and pass out favors to enhance the last of the fossil fuel economy. Well, like on a worldwide scale, Secretary General Ban of the UN noted there's about $5.2 trillion of institutions that are divesting of fossil fuels. It's not just Dakota Access. It's the fact that the fossil fuel economy is not working out over the long haul. You know, I'm encouraging people to start now their divestment in Enbridge, because this is a project that has not happened. It is not going to happen, and we could use a lot of help of people, like looking at these banks that we're just starting to. If you go to our Stop Line 3 website or Honor the Earth website, you know, we'll give you some guidance there. But, you know, it's just a bad idea anyway, because, you know, Trump and Trudeau, between the two of them, they approved, like, kind of willy-nilly all these pipelines, Trans Mountain, Enbridge Line 3, Keystone XL. And in Canada, they're looking at this one called Energy East, which would probably end up with some tankers off of Maine. The total expansion of Canadian export pipeline capacity with all those projects would be 7.1 million barrels of oil per day. 7.1 million barrels of oil today. That's a lot of climate change. And if you added in current rail capacity, the total capacity would be 7.9 million barrels per day. So the Globe and Mail, Toronto's big paper, pointed out that all of that greed, there's a surplus pipeline capacity of 2.4 million barrels per day by 2025, less than 8 years from now. And the thing is, because, you know, Alberta lost 20,000 jobs this last year. Price of oil is not high enough for the tar sands. And, you know, in terms of a worldwide divestment, the tar sands is not projected to grow after, you know, the next couple of years if they could get these through. Shell just moved out. So these companies are so greedy. They are, you know, trying to invest in some oil that is not going to ever come out. And so it's a poor investment for a corporation, a poor investment for an investor to invest in these fossil fuels projects. Time to invest in solar, renewable, local food.
You know, Winona, you mentioned these pipelines. The purpose of these pipelines is to transport these products for export,
exactly,
not for domestic consumption. Mm-hmm. It's not going to lower the price of oil for consumers in this country. And I wonder, even, does it create jobs? Esther.
Right. And one of the things that I wanted to ask Winona is about the capacity of reservations to invest in renewable energy and to be sites of places to build solar and to have solar farms, mm-hmm, so that we're not just countering these dirty fossil fuel companies, but actually engaging in the new economy with wind farm and solar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so you look at Enbridge, and Enbridge itself, not to just be talking about them, but they have about a $5 billion, I think they better move to a $6 billion renewable energy portfolio. So what I'm trying to ask them is why they want to bring us $7 billion worth of junk.
Right.
Why does that company that's already going renewable want to bring us so much junk? And then kind of in the bigger picture, or not only just the bigger picture there, but, you know, our tribes, you know, Indian reservations have vast wind and solar potential. And, you know, we did some looking at it, you know, and Standing Rock is looking at a large wind project. You know, our reservation is working on solar and wind. And we're actually, our organization is doing small-scale solar thermal manufacturing. And, you know, because what we see is that our people are cold. They don't need to pay for fossil fuels. They would be much better off. Energy security would be best defined by, you know, renewables. And not dead oil pipelines. You know, so that's kind of what we're looking at Honor the Earth and here on the White Earth Reservation. We did a little math out there at the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the $3.9 billion that Energy Transfer Partners paid out for the Dakota Access Pipeline, along with their friends at Enbridge, would have bought 323 2-megawatt wind turbines at about 163,000 solar panels, 5 kilowatts each for the houses of North Dakota, and then about another 60,000, something like that, of passive solar thermal. You know, that's what energy self-sufficiency looks like, not some oil pipelines. You know, so that's what I'm thinking about. You know, it is for export, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we're just going to have a bunch of junk. And that's a huge liability for everybody here.
And that was Winona LaDuc from White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. She was on the national broadcast, the Pacifica broadcast of the People's Climate March live from Washington, D.C. on Saturday. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Greta Anderson, here with Susan Franzen, my co-host, and we've been joined by a regular correspondent. We call him our wildlife correspondent, Pat Schlarbaum. Pat has been a wildlife specialist for the Department of Natural Resources in Iowa for 32 years, he tells us. And he is getting ready to retire at age 66.
Yeah, I get full Social Security at Saturday morning, June 10th.
Happy birthday ahead of the time.
You, yeah. Yeah, full moon, June 9th, so I get to saunter off into the full moon.
That's the way it should be. And we have a few minutes here to talk about what this means for someone who has been working all their life with educating the public about wildlife to retire. And unfortunately, in these circumstances right now, it looks like you do not have a replacement at your job.
Well, that's correct. It'd be a lot more sustainable to pass the work forward to the next woman or the next guy. But unfortunately, I'll be wrapping things up. But it is a privilege to observe the people of the wildlife community. I think I kind of go from the standpoint that I'm a go-between. People that have appreciation of these incredible resources, and then when they get a chance to see a river otter or a sandhill crane or a bald eagle flying overhead, I mean, that's their moment. So it's a privilege to kind of link those things together. So it's been 32 years of environmental or outreach programs, but always with a partner. The County Conservation Board system in Iowa is just phenomenal. We're just so fortunate right here in Story County to have the folks out at McFarland. So there it is. The role will shift, but fortunately I've had the honor to work with these other naturalists around the state. So hopefully they'll be able to pick up some of the projects that I've been involved with and go from there.
Well, let's talk about some of those projects, okay, because there's been a lot of change in the wildlife community during these 32 years that you've been working for the Iowa DNR.
Yeah, that's interesting that that does come to light with bald eagle nesting. For instance, in 1985, I think we'd gone from our first successful nest in 1977, and then we started picked up a second one. Of course, the only thing better than an eagle nest is a second eagle nest. And it grew from there. Our outreach included a replica bald eagle nest that was designed to share the excitement of nesting bald eagles in Iowa. And I think in 1988, we'd gone from 2 to 4 nesting pairs. Last year, one of my coworkers, Stephanie Shepherd, who's our prairie and butterfly expert, but she keeps track of the eagle nests. Over 400 nesting bald eagles in Iowa. That far exceeded anything people would have even dreamed of in 1985 or growing up. You know, bald eagles are just a picture in a book. And in the low point before banning DDT, there were estimated to be 435, I think, in the lower 48 contiguous states. Well, now we have over 400 in Iowa. And how to share that excitement and not spoil it or jinx it or go backwards is kind of been the work and the goal. I think they're here to guide us to do more. Again, you know, they just lift your spirits. And one of the early projects were American kestrels. They were
Stick with the eagles just a second, because you mentioned this nest of this big nest. And folks, this is something that Pat is known to haul around in the back end of his pickup. You'll see a big. Some people will say, "What are all those sticks doing in Pat's truck? What is that?" It is a replica of a bald eagle's nest. You put a few screws in to keep things
in
place.
It doesn't disassemble itself going down the highway.
Right.
People follow me into the Casey's, and, you know, when I'm gassing up, and think, I thought, well, everybody's seen this nest since 1988, but yet everywhere it goes, there's always somebody that, what compelled you to cut that nest out of a tree? What's going on? Where are you taking it? Where's it going? They say, well, it's a replica. It's not a fake, but because I do use genuine bald eagle sticks from other nests and nests that have come down. So, but it's a kid magnet. They can kind of look at it and experience. And I let to sit little toddlers in it, and the grandparents and folks love that.
Do you take it off the truck
everywhere
the kids
I go,
get in?
There's partners. I've had the good fortune of lining up three other people. It takes about four of us to set it off, and that way I can set kids in it. But in the new world of the replica eagle nest, I just put it on a trailer for Earth Day. I was up in Clear Lake. And with the steps, I'm able to set kids in it from a trailer. So now it's got its own wheels. System kind of evolved where in the back of the truck was a lot easier, especially on snowy, icy roads.
Well, I was wondering what it was like to build that nest, whether when you actually built it, you know, did you channel your inner eagle mom, you know, and eagle dad?
A great friend, Mark Edwards, we went around and looked at trees and tried to figure out the one that might be suitable for this replica nest. And we started with a willow because I thought, well, it'll be light. And it was out of scale, you know. We just drove around and said, oh, there it is. And it was in a honey locust tree. But I wanted to get three branches that would kind of simulate what a replica, where it would be. And yet we were really imagining them. I had never seen a real bald eagle nest. They were literally a picture in a book.
That was that rare.
Yeah,
goodness.
So we'd go get sticks. And, you know, then I discovered that if you got near a beaver dam or certain areas or it was a wash where I could get sticks, because I didn't want to cut, you know, like hickories or things to have the saw end, you know.
Right.
They had to be broken or somehow naturalized. So it kind of grew from there, and we thought we were done. And then you'd look at it, well, maybe we'll go get another load of sticks. And then we'd go around and around and around. And it was before cordless drills. So I had I'd drill a pilot hole, and then use a sheetrock screw. That was, and so you drill the hole, then install the screw, and just go around and around and around until the cords all got wrapped up. And then you'd reverse the tread and go around and around and around back counterclockwise. And in the end, you ended up with this big pile of sticks.
Well, I guess a typical bird might actually be weaving some actual thing in there.
And by golly, there's been people say, you know, at that time, eagle experts said, yeah, put that up in a tree. And I imagine it would be a platform that eagles would link up with it. And by the way, when the Decora eagle nest came down in July of 2015, just broke Bob Anderson's heart. He was the director of the Raptor Resource Project, kind of
right.
The guru, the father of the Decora Eagle Cam. When that tree came down, it was devastating because the camera came down with it, and he knew that they would rebuild, but you couldn't go and install the camera in the new nest until they were had successfully nested, and because you wouldn't want to disturb.
You missed a year.
Yeah, so there was a message there on just timing, but by that happened on a Sunday night, and by Wednesday, we thought, you know, maybe we could put a replica nest up in the cottonwood tree close by. So where the nest came down, we took, I'd gathered sticks and things, and a guy named Kiki Arnold from the Amazon area was a world climber, and we just sent sticks up to him, and he fashioned a replica nest, and that was in August of 2015, and then last year, well, in October of 2015, the eagles came back, landed on it. How'd we know we were ready for eagles? He was jumping up and down. I said, make it as solid and as sturdy as you can. And lo and behold, in October then of 2015, Eagles came back, landed on it, started carrying sticks. They completed it, and then successfully fledged two young last year, and they're in it today. So it,
that's amazing.
So so the replicant nest kind of took on an added dimension, if you will, or whatever word. It grew. There was growth and development that a replicant nest did have a functionality.
Yeah. So. It's a prefab eagle's nest.
Prefab. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's like processed food. It's like microwave work. Yeah, it just happens.
Yeah. Well, you get your prefab house, and you fill it out.
But
it is an
interesting mess of sticks. You know, it's just, yeah. And it doesn't disassemble itself going down the road. So that's been one aspect of the 32 years.
And are you keeping your nest or
moving it on? I'm hoping the Iowa Wildlife Center. We're looking for a home. There's five others that I've helped Eagle Scout projects and things. And so the places it's gone for the events, certain events now have their own replica eagle nest. So it'll be looking for a new life, I guess. And I'm not sure exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a bird sort of looking over our shoulder right now at us. It's not a bald eagle. You've told us it's an osprey.
Yeah.
It's a you know, stuffed
Native
osprey.
People, they would refer to these as fish hawks or fish eagles, the birds that drop out of the sky. They only weigh about 4 pounds, so they're where an eagle might be 11 or 12. So they're considerably diminutive, but the same wingspan. I mean, so in flight, you kind of look for the black and white birds. They have a lot of white on their stomach. But they're the ones that drop out of the sky and get fish. Whereas a bald eagle would kind of skim the surface and snatch a fish.
Okay.
These birds will just plummet down upon them. They target a fish that's close to the surface. They don't swim underwater, but a fish that's close to the surface would be vulnerable. And they're white from underneath, so the fish really doesn't see what's coming. But when they bring down those talons with nature's finest fish hooks, and when they hit the water, it's a pretty loud retort. I mean, it's a smack. And then you'll see the water sort of twitching, and this bird has opened up its wings, and they have a double joint so that they can kind of push down and hop away from the water. And if a 4-pound bird will have a 2-pound fish, and you think mathematically this isn't happening.
Right.
And yet, you know, because even the water cohesive forces, you know, and the fish is alive. So this whole thing, they push down and hop up out of the water, and they'll get a stroke in. And, of course, the bird's wringing wet, you know, so it's a 4-pound bird with, I don't know, half a pound of water maybe. And they'll take a stroke and another powerful stroke. And about the fourth one, they're up high enough to where they can kind of start wringing the water away like a dog would, you know. And the water's just flying these diamondized droplets, and you got this bird with a fish that's obviously trying to, you know, disentangle itself from the talons, and this bird is flying off with a fish, and they have another anatomical feature at that point. Where the 3-in-1, usually raptors or most birds, they have 3 toes and then a helix or the rear talon. But an osprey can swivel, and rather than be 3-in-1, they can swivel one of the talons and make it 2-by-2. So then they're clamped. But rather than carry the fish like perpendicular to their flight direction, they'll line it up so that it's like torpedo style, so that there's less wind resistance. And this is happening while the fish is trying to disentangle itself. And sometimes it'll only have it by one talon then, you know, and it's trying to get the other talon on it. And, of course, then there's another osprey or an eagle in the area saying, oh, there's a fish, let's go, you know. Yeah. Then they have to almost defend it to get up to the perch. And after a while, you're looking at this osprey then, you know, eating its fish.
Deserving every bite.
It's like, wow, what did I just see? But people can see ospreys now. In 85, there was some summering in Iowa. But it was necessary for there to spread their population that was basically centered in upper Wisconsin and an area near Deerwood, Minnesota, where they're sharing their ospreys with us. So we started bringing ospreys to Iowa as young birds before that were flightless.
So this is a little different from the bald eagle.
Came back on their own.
Right.
Yeah. But these ospreys, it's a 25-cent term, biological term, natal site fidelity. Essentially, when they go return to nest at 3 or 4 years, when they achieve maturity, they go back to where they were first.
Yeah.
Where their parents and their grand. So these areas just become so osprey-rich because they keep going back to where they originated. So if they have two or three young, we always had to leave one, but there was a relocation of these young ospreys. And our partners then would take care of four or five and release them. And we were able to achieve successful nesting of surviving ospreys in Iowa in 2003. And since that time, there's going to be 26 or 27 nests this year. There's webcams. People can see if they go to the Iowa DNR Osprey Cam, you can see some that are nesting in Iowa now. So, yeah.
So you kind of like imprint a new nesting place
imprint's
on
a
them.
Good word. Yeah. Yeah. So that's how it's worked, you know. Uh-huh. But it's been 11 sites, 11 different key partners. And we're going to have a big thank you for all the partners. May 20th. At Colfax, Iowa, which is in Jasper County.
That's not too far.
There's two nesting pairs there, and they hit the water a lot. In fact, there's two nesting pairs, but they had as many as seven here a couple weeks ago. So ospreys are social. That's why they can nest side by side. That's why they keep going back to those areas as long as there's fish.
It's like a family reunion.
Quite a lineage. So we've got something in Iowa where the northern areas, the wild areas, are being shared. We get a bit of that wildness here. You see them out at Ada Hayden. We're hoping we've got some, because they readily will get on a platform, on a pole, whereas the tree they would use in a natural setting would have the tops twisted out. They cannot deal with any branches. So that's why you see them on fishing buoys and anything man-made. Our cell phone towers have become very rich with osprey habitat because there's no – they're elevated. They have 360-degree visibility for their own protection and protection of their young, defending that site from intruders like raccoons or bald eagles or probably great horned owls and maybe red-tailed hawks. So they're exposed. They helicopter up and down. They cannot deal – those lanky wings that – allow them to get the fish, can't deal with branches, and they're just not a really sturdy bird like the bald eagles. But their talents far exceed nature's finest fish hook. So May 20th, just to let people know, we're going to thank all the partners. And part of the work has involved Chief Golden Light Eagle with the Yankton Nation. He would come and do blessings for the Red Rock birds when we were there in, like, late 2000s, 2006 and 7. And he was here 4 years. And that's kind of established a friendship with him. And so he's going to come and be a part of the thank you. Mm-hmm. And we're going to recognize all the people. It's a picnic, so you can learn about it at our website. 11 a.m. May 20th down at Jasper County.
We will link on that on our website.
And you'll get to see ospreys in the wild fishing. You can hear the words of the chief and how what this work has meant to him and his native culture. Because they said that the eagles would welcome the return of the ospreys, he told us.
The first time I ever heard of an osprey was when somebody saw an eagle flying over and the osprey flying over with a bird in its, a fish in its talons, and the eagle came down and the osprey dropped the fish.
No.
And I've heard other people see this exact scenario. The eagles can't do what the ospreys can do, so that they can intimidate them.
Bully.
Yeah, they go right. Yeah, they go right for it. But,
quite a partnership.
And as they say, you know, have a good time in life. Just don't drop your fish. You know, from an osprey perspective.
Well,
thanks for this opportunity.
Pat, you've definitely given our listeners a reminder of what made you such an effective educator with that image of the osprey coming up with the wriggling, struggling fish and pumping his wings to get up there. That's a word picture that I think it's perfect for the radio, Pat. And you've been so good to us to share your insights and your seasonal reminders of what to look for.
Well, it's a privilege to serve. And I would like to mention that our environment, you know, requires maintenance. It requires attention, just like, you know, your earlier interviews. And there's a sustainability that we weave into the environment. And to those of us here at the station, you know, the only thing more important that, you know, a part of our environment here is community radio.
That's right.
Let's link with, you know, the sustainability of the environment with the sustainability of a community radio station. So let's just really consider, I hope all the any listener out there that's kind of close to the edge of saying, we can grow this sort of community radio station right here in Ames, Iowa. And it's a wonderful opportunity.
We've done it just like the birds.
All three of you are just fantastic here. You know, Cynthia, thank you, Susan. Thank you, Greta. And I hope any listeners out there realize that we need a sustainable radio station. Consider contributing, you know, $55 for an annual membership or $250 for sustainability. Be a sustainable member of community radio.
Pat, what are you doing to celebrate your retirement besides this May 20th event?
I guess that'll be the last public event, May 20th. And then we're going to do a picnic June 9th, Lower Ledges. Probably eat up a lot of the things that we save from the Osprey picnic. Thank you. So I'll be saying thanks to all the coworkers and people that I've had the privilege of working with for 32 plus years. And so that'll be 11 at the Lower Ledges. Anybody's listening will want to come by and rub shoulders with some wildlife folks because the wildlife diversity team have just been, they're just fabulous. Karen Kincaid and Stephanie Shepherd and Bruce Erisman and Paul Fraze. So then that evening is a full moon. So I'm going to saunter off into the full moon the next morning, sign up for full Social Security with plans to go nowhere and plans to spend no money. And we'll see how long I can get away with that.
Okay. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I've been one of your hosts, Greta Anderson, together with Susan Franz, and we started out the show with climatologist Elwyn Taylor. Then we heard a range of voices from the Climate March, Heather Pearson, Shelley Buffalo, Akeo Abdul-Samad, and 15-year-old Ellery McAllister. We also heard from Winona LaDuke of White Earth Reservation. Her organization is Honor the Earth, and her website is honorearth.org. We were joined by Pat Schlarbaum of the Iowa DNR, who is facing a milestone and will retire from his position as wildlife specialist after 32 years.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org.
And Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878.
Also, tell your friends if you like this show. And remember, your participation as listener, your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Please go to khoifm.org, press the Donate Now button.
Or come down to the station and give us a gift in person. We'd love to see you.
In the meantime, thanks for listening. And
we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.